The Father Brown Stories by G.K. Chesterton. We present The Invisible Man, adapted by John Scotney, with Andrew Sachs as Father Brown.
There could be no character more different from the tough, streetwise, trench-coated American private eyes of our two previous Radio Detectives programmes than today's subject, an innocent, guileless, Catholic parish priest from East Anglia. Small, bespectacled, absent-minded, and invariably clutching an oversized umbrella and a collection of brown paper parcels.
Anything to declare?
No, I don't think so.
There. I hope you've got your umbrella. Your famous umbrella?
My umbrella? I didn't think I had to declare it. Just a little wisecrack.
A joke, Father Brown? A joke?
Oh, but you know my name, but I've never been here before. Know your name, Father Brown?
Well, I reckon just about everyone in little old New York's heard of your exploits.
Really?
Boy! I can tell you Father Brown's clean.
Hey.
And I'm sure he'll be happy to answer your question.
Well, Hoffman, in the New York Bugle. Hey, Father Brown, how do you explain the recent crime wave in New York City, huh?
Oh, is there one?
Is there going to be a war, sir, between the German Kaiser and the British Empire? This year, next year?
I would really...
Come on now, boys, come on. Give Father Brown a break.
Thank you all.
Father Brown's the most celebrated creation of the English man of letters, G.K. Chesterton, poet, biographer, essayist and critic. The Little Priest made his debut in 1910 in the Storyteller magazine, and from then until his death in 1936, Chesterton produced more than 50 Father Brown stories, most of them collected in 5 separate volumes. Chesterton acknowledged that Father Brown was based intellectually, if not in appearance, on his friend Father John O'Connor, an Irish priest based in Bradford. What were his qualities as a detective story writer? Cultural historian Owen Dudley Edwards.
Chesterton is quite an extraordinary detective story writer. In almost all cases, you will find that the detective story writer spends a great deal of time developing the detective, trying various forms of showing appropriate or inappropriate eccentricities for the detective, and so forth. Chesterton, having invented Father Brown, does very, very little with him beyond the original. Father Brown himself is certainly an extremely impressive, attractive figure, but we find out practically nothing about him. In one of the very last stories, The Worst Crime in the World, we discover he has a somewhat silly sister. Father Brown is, from time to time, a parish priest in England. At one point, is in America as a chaplain in a prison in Chicago in the 1890s. At another point, he arrives in America sometime in the 1920s, and it is stated he has never been in America before. As the great critic of Father Brown, W.W. Robson, put it, never has so great a character been handled so roughly by his maker. Sometimes the various stories themselves are not very good detective stories, but almost every single detective story about Father Brown contains a gem of insight on some question on some point or another. But Father Brown's general demeanor of being somebody who seems to be a bumbler, somebody who often seems to have a lot of difficulty making himself be understood, and then he becomes devastatingly the supremely wise figure where the capacities of people at ordinary civilities of speech shrink down to the merest absurd trivialities, and very frequently exposing people as saying things they don't really mean or haven't thought through. There's a great philosophy behind this particular detective.
Oh, look at that. Might be a map of the world, mightn't it, down there?
Yes. Be careful of looking so sharply down. It can be disturbing.
Yes. Yes, there's a monstrous disproportion. From below, this huge stone griffin. Yes, it looks quite small and harmless, but from here, it's like a great dragon stalking the fields. You know, heights were made to be looked at, not looked from.
Yes, one may fall.
One's soul may fall if one's body doesn't.
I scarcely understand you.
I think there's something rather dangerous about standing on these high places, even to pray.
Father, you don't believe Mad Joe did it, do you?
No.
It would explain the small hammer.
Yes, but we know he didn't do it, don't we? Joe would have used a blacksmith's hammer, a hammer used to work metal. But the weapon was a hammer of another kind, one used for working wood, a carpenter's hammer.
Father Brown.
No, there was a man once who began by worshipping with others, kneeling on the floor before the altar, but who grew fond of high and lonely places to pray from. And in one of those dizzy places where the world seemed to turn under him like a wheel, his brain turned also, and he came to fancy he was God. It must seem easy to judge the world from up here, to believe it is given to you to strike down the sinner.
You? Are you a devil?
I am a man, and therefore have all devils in my heart. From here it all looks so simple, doesn't it? Whether you come up here to pray, or with a set of carpenter's tools to mend a wooden railing, to look down and see all men as insects, and to see one particular poisonous insect.
How do you understand all this?
It's so simple, not just to judge, but to execute sentence. For you have at hand, here, one of the awful engines of nature, gravitation, that mad and quickening rush by which all things of the earth fly back to her heart. The dreadful, unfleshly power of gravitation, whereby if dropped from a great height, even a small hammer would strike as a lethal bullet.
No,
come back, come here. No, I will quite simply not allow you to jump. That door leads to hell. Now come down to earth with me. You're not yet far wrong, as assassins go. You would not allow the crime to be fixed on the smith or his wife. You tried to fix it on the imbecile who could not be punished. Come, come away from these stone-carved angels and devils. Come down into the world of men. And when we reach the floor of the nave, I will leave you there at ground level to make your own decision. And then go your own way as free as the wind. I will seal this with the seal of the confessional. Now, I've said my last word.
Chesterton famously became a Catholic convert in 1922. How far were his stories influenced by his Catholicism?
Chesterton was not a Roman Catholic when he invented the Father Brown stories. He had simply met a priest whom he liked very much. He was, by this stage, a very high Anglican. But he did find Roman Catholicism a bit alien, and that apparently was the thing that kept him outside the Roman Catholic Church until about 1922. So almost exactly half of the Father Brown stories were written long before Chesterton became a Roman Catholic. The detective stories, the other ones which were to follow, slightly more in number, were written after the conversion in 22. One can see differences immediately. Then, towards the latter part of his career, he publishes The Scandal of Father Brown and after it The Vampire of the Village, and all of these, with possibly one exception, are absolutely top flight among the very best things he did in the Father Brown basis. So you could say that Roman Catholicism actually weakened his prowess as a detective story writer in the initial instance. In a sense, he had entered something of whose magnitude he was overwhelmingly conscious and obviously felt anxious to express a celebration of his new Roman Catholicism through Father Brown. Then he got it much more into perspective towards the end.
Chesterton also used his stories as a vehicle for his political views.
The politics of the detective story are an important aspect which should be considered. Father Brown, as a series of stories, have a political basis which is, like the Sherlock Holmes stories, critical in class terms of an idle upper class, but much more strongly than the Sherlock Holmes stories, anti-capitalist. Time and again, the figure of the left-wing socialist, possibly communist, turns out to be the innocent figure. although at the time when Chesterton was writing, much Catholic writing in Britain would have been primarily anti-communist, much more than anti-capitalist. Here in the stories, it's very much the other way around. These are passionately hostile to a culture of greed. They are passionately hostile to make a virtue of making money. They lose no opportunity for whatsoever of showing up ways in which the so-called respectable are in fact people who are destroying society and destroying their fellow human beings.
A thorough grasp of the nuances of Edwardian class society lay behind many of Father Brown's deductions, as for instance in The Queer Feet.
Do you know, Colonel, this archangel of impudence who stole your forks walked up and down this very passage 20 times in the blaze of all the lamps, in the glare of all eyes?
Good God.
Don't ask me what he was like. You yourself have seen him 6 or 7 times tonight. Yes, this way, along here. You see, Colonel, I was shut up in this small room. It's along here to the left.
Good Lord, the place is a maze.
Yes. I was doing some writing when I heard a pair of feet in the passage doing a dance that was, in its way, as queer as the dance of death. Now, the heavy steps I recognized, they were, if you'll excuse me, very like yours.
Oh.
It was the walk of a well-fed gentleman waiting for something and strolls about because he's physically alert rather than mentally impatient.
But there were other steps?
Yes, funny little steps, definitely made by the same man. Now, what wild creature, I thought, tears about on tiptoe in that extraordinary style? Then I remembered Mr. Lever saying he found nothing unusual in those footsteps. Of course not. I realize he hears them every day, all day. It was the walk of a waiter. That walk with the body slanted forward, the eyes looking down, the ball of the toe spurning the ground, and coattails and napkins flying. Now, why should the same person sound like a gentleman one moment and a waiter the next?
Wait a second. Think I'm ahead of you. You say the thief wore evening dress.
Yes.
So do waiters. When he was with us, he pretended to be the 15th waiter. After all, we can't tell one waiter from another. Then when the waiters were about, he paid the gentleman. That's the thought. I suppose they can't tell us apart either.
Exactly.
Dramatizations of the Father Brown stories inevitably beckoned. Alec Guinness played him in the film Father Brown in 1954, which concerns Father Brown's battle to save the soul of master jewel thief Flambeau, who later turns private detective and assists Father Brown in some of his cases. In 1974, Kenneth Moore undertook the role in a Father Brown television series on ITV. But above all, since the early days of the medium, both in series and single plays, Father Brown has been a radio regular. During the 1930s and 1940s, he was played on the wireless by, among others, Elliot Macomb, Richard Goulden, George Owen, and Gordon Fillott. Sadly, none of these performances have been preserved. However, examples do survive of the 13 half-hour dramatizations broadcast between 1984 and 1986, which starred Andrew Sachs as Father Brown. They were produced by Alec Reed. How and why did he decide to do the Father Brown stories?
Well, yes, I mean, I suppose the idea actually started in a darkened cinema in Ealing Broadway in about 1954 or thereabouts, when I went to see a film, and there was a trailer with it, with bits of Alec Guinness rushing around and Father Brown in big letters coming up all over the place. And I thought, that's interesting, I must see that film. And I didn't. And then, you know, spool forward through to about 1984 or thereabouts, I was then a radio drama producer in Broadcasting House here in London. And every week the department had what they called their script meeting, where producers would be receiving scripts from writers day in, day out. And somewhere down the line, there was suddenly a gap for a series. So anybody have any ideas? And I just had this flash of this trailer from 1954 or thereabouts come through my head, and I said, well, it'd be quite interesting to do the Father Brown stories. I can't remember them being done, and so on and so forth. And everybody sort of perked up at that. I think partly because Richard Imerson, who then ran the script unit, the radio drama department, was an enthusiast anyway. And so it was agreed that that's what we would do. And Richard said, well, I have just the adapter for you. And John Scotney's name was produced, and you know, John and I been in radio drama department together for a period of time, knew each other well anyway. So I thought, fine, chance to work together. And that was it.
What was the appeal of the stories for John Scotney?
I think the appeal of the Father Brown story is maybe the same appeal as Miss Marple's. The unlikely detective. The person who in every way seems wrong, but has the bright... We're all that person, really. We can't be Sherlock Holmes. We can be Miss Marples. We can be Father Brown. Chesterton was a man who said that the only way he could ever catch a train was by missing the previous one, and that's Father Brown. It belongs to a strange tradition of detective stories that they're really a kind of fairyland. They're not in the real world. Every other detective has a reason for being involved in whatever happens. Father Brown just happens to be there. In story after story, the little priest from around the corner is called because someone's fallen ill. He's on holiday somewhere. He's kind of Jonah, really. Everywhere he goes, crimes are committed. But he's never a consulting detective. He is always the priest. Also, I think, the nice idea of the moralist. There are plenty of things in Chesterton that I don't agree with. But I like the idea of a man who's interested in the morality of crime, not just the existence of crime, not the science of crime, but the reason for doing it. Again and again, the stories end with Father Brown going off and having a long talk with whichever villain it is, which is always under the seal of the confessional, so we never know actually what is said.
And what problems did the stories present to him as dramatiser?
The stories did present problems. I had a big debate with myself, and indeed I discussed it with Andrew and with Alec, because Andrew's himself a distinguished writer, of course, as to whether we had a narrator or not. Most of my writing for radio, I've had a narrator. I love the concept of a narrator on radio, because you can talk as we're talking now, you can talk through the microphone. And it was really very strange for me not to have a narrator, because we got all the wonderful prose and so on. But what worried me was this combination of John O'Connor and Chesterton and the personality of Father Brown. So what I ended up doing, in fact, was doing away with the concept of a narrator, but putting lots of pieces of Chesterton's comments into Father Brown's mouth. Some of the other problems were just quite simply more practical. The stories are quite short. 10 pages. And filling half an hour, in a half-hour slot, you can afford a main plot and a sort of bit of subplot. If you just have the main plot, which the stories are, it does seem very thin. So I did find, and I apologise to Chestertonians, that I had to add lots and lots of bits. Sometimes I stole them from other stories. I had to invent the character. Frankly, I don't remember whether I invented the character of Bagshaw or whether he isn't perhaps in one of the stories. He was very useful to me because, again, in lots of the stories, there's only one person present. And we need someone for Father Brown to talk to. And then, of course, he represents the more human side of in The Eye of Apollo. He falls for one of the characters.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, don't talk to me about the police. Now I know what they mean when they say when you want one, you can't find one. Blow my whistle for 5 minutes, I was, before any uniform branch turned up. Oh, this is the deceased sister, Miss Joan Stacy.
Yes.
Oh, of course you both know her. you must be Kalon. Right, I've got my breath back. We might as well get started. I don't mind telling you, I can't put my finger on it, but something stinks here. It looks like an accident, could even be suicide, but I smell murder. Now, Mr. Kalon, what were you doing just before before Miss Stacy fell?
Going into Stacy's office with a document for Pauline to sign. Then I went upstairs to commence my prayer.
Upstairs?
Just for the record, what was the document you were taking to be signed?
It was Miss Pauline Stacy's will. She'd asked me to check it before she signed. Pauline did love me. And this very morning before she died, she wrote on that table a will leaving me and my church £500,000. See for yourself. The will is on the table over there.
I give and bequeath to Chatham. My knowledge of English law may be limited, but how is this valid? It is not signed.
Not signed? Oh. What? What monkey tricks you've been up to, Joan?
Oh, dare you.
See here, gentlemen. Here's your death explained. The poor girl is writing her will in my favor. Her cursed sister here comes in, struggles for the pen, drags her to the staff, then throws her down before she can finish.
Mr. Caylon, Miss Stacy here has the same alibi as the other chief suspect. I myself was only a few yards from her when the murder occurred.
Who is the other chief suspect?
You are, Flombeau.
Mm-hmm. And I?
Well, yes, you do have a motive.
But I am called to dock. Many hundred people will go into the witness box and testify that I was standing on my balcony, 2 floors above Pauline's office when she fell to her death. Could I be in 2 places at once?
I don't know. Father Brown.
So the little inquisitor defers to the grand inquisitor.
There have, I feel, been sins committed here, sins of omission and sins of commission. But I doubt whether they could lead to a conviction in a court of law.
Other problems would be Chesterton was not terribly hot on doing his research and checking things. Again, to take something like the Eye of Apollo, the story is about this strange creature who founds a new religion, and the trick to it is quite simply the lift door is left open and a short-sighted lady walks through it, falls to her death, and it can't be the head of the religion because he's outside on the balcony. But I had to add lots of little bits to it. There were things that weren't quite consistent in the story as to how the lift actually remained on the wrong floor.
Casting is, of course, crucial in radio drama, never more so than in detective stories. Al agreed.
Any series that revolves around one character is the casting of the actor for that character. In fact, in Father Brown, there was the central character, and there were two key subsidiary characters as well that had to be thought about. And when I first went down to Bristol, I shared an office with a producer, now retired, called Margaret Bradley. She was producing Poetry Please and things like that, and I was responsible for Time for Verse, so we had a common interest there. And she said, well, you know, what other things are you doing now you've come down here sort of thing? I said, well, I just sold this series based on the Father Brown stories, and, you know, it looks going to be great fun. But now it's up to me to try and find the ideal actor to play Father Brown. And she sort of paused for me and said, well, have you thought of Andrew Sachs? And immediately she said it, of course. It was as if I'd thought that all the time. But in fact, she was the first one to say that. And I was able to immediately relax at that point because I knew we'd got the centre of the piece.
What qualities did Andrew Sachs bring to the role of Father Brown? John Scottney.
Writing for Andrew. I knew what I would get from him. I knew that he could convey Father Brown's benevolence, his bumbliness, and cutting through it the incisive mind. It's not enough just to make him a bumbly figure. There are too many detectives with incisive minds. So I knew he would be able to flesh out the character. He did give me some excellent criticism, some of the scripts, and a couple of them we actually rewrote together, or maybe more than that, to help make them work in with the character. It's wonderful to be able to write something and know who is playing the part. You can do so much with it that suits that person. You can hear their voice. You know how they're going to handle certain things. So it was smashing having him.
What attracted Andrew Sachs to the role of Father Brown?
One of the appeals of doing what amounts to the classics, really, and in particular this one, is this Englishness. I somehow have a sneaking envy of people who are English, very English, and I don't belong to that group at all. I mean, the people who are at home on a cricket field or watching cricket or in a pub or the old type of gentlemen's clubs that they used to have, turn of the century, the Edwardian period, the Englishness of it is very appealing to me in a strange way, empire and so on. I come from a different culture in Germany, and so I was a bit of an outsider and still am in that respect. And writing in what must be the best language that I know of, to write in and to be able to perform those words has enormous appeal for me.
And what was the nature of his working relationship with the producer?
Alec is taller than I am, so I tend to have to do what I'm told. And he does put, I require guidance, and I get very inconfident when I'm just left to it. I like to be told, even if it's wrong or right, I don't mind, or constructive criticism, I do find I flourish under that. So he gave me that, plenty of it, and John was always around as well.
Unusually for radio drama, the cast were taken on location for one story, The Sins of Prince Saradin.
For some reason, I think maybe Alec is a bit of a sadist as well. He likes to get us out on location occasionally. And when we were making these in the 80s, it wasn't that common to leave the confines of the studio. So he took us on a very cold day. It was the Chew Valley Reservoir he took us to. Why, I have no idea. And he got us into this boat, Flambeau and me, Olivier Pierre, who's a big man, and me, who's not quite as big. Mike Burgess, the recording engineer, was with us. Alec was wise and stayed with dry feet on shore. And the boat was leaking. So I nearly drowned to death.
How does Chesterton expert Owen Dudley Edwards rate Andrew Sachs's Father Brown?
The performance by Andrew Sachs is Father Brown in the voice, in the way that Alec Guinness was Father Brown in the flesh. The first reaction to it seems to me, is, oh, no, this is far too English. But, of course, Father Brown is English, very English. And merely because I am an Irish Roman Catholic, am I to think that the English cannot be Roman Catholics too?
St. Francis Xavier's, this is Father Brown speaking. Goodbye. That was the police, sister.
Oh, Mother of God. Oh, I'm sorry, Father. But what would the police be wanting with us?
Oh, begorra, I should never have put the Holy Father's head on the counterfeit sovereign.
You're mocking me, Father.
I'm sorry. It's a gentleman called Inspector Bagshaw. I met him last November. He wanted to see me about a man called Flambeau.
G.K. Chesterton used the money he made from the Father Brown stories to fund what he regarded as his real work, editing G.K.'s Weekly, a magazine which he used to promote the philosophy of distributism, the equal division of the land amongst the people to recreate a rural yeomanry. Distributism is forgotten. Father Brown is immortal. Which suggests that authors are not always the best judges of what is their best work.
In The Eye of Apollo by G.K. Chesterton, the part of Father Brown was played by Andrew Sachs. Flambeau, Olivier Pierre. Bagshaw, Bill Wallace. Kalin, Bruce Boer. Pauline Stacey, Narissa Knight. Joan Stacey, Lisa Flanagan. Wilson, Garrick Hagen. Sister, Melinda Walker. News vendor, Robin Summers. The Eye of Apollo was adapted by John Scotney and directed in Bristol by Alec Reed.